This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Myanmar gets ready for an apparent historic political change. Syrian government abductions drive black market profits. Disturbing educational trends emerge in the U.S.
Latino children and African American children, once again, attending schools that are highly segregated. They're highly segregated by race, by poverty, by language, by legal status.
The life of an international football star gets the movie treatment. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Myanmar President Thein Sein congratulated opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy Party, the NLD, for its apparent landslide victory in this week's parliamentary elections. The latest results show the NLD winning 179 out of 216 seats. That's more than 80% of the results announced so far for the lower house of parliament. The NLD is also far ahead in the upper chamber of parliament, winning 77 of the 83 seats announced so far. VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman told International Edition Sarah Williams it appears a transfer of power will be orderly.
There's little doubt now that the opposition NLD is heading towards a landslide victory. And what is more remarkable is that the government is now acknowledging that and reaching out to Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD and saying from the president's office directly that President Thein Sein will work for a peaceful transition of power. And the president apparently has also accepted Aung San Suu Kyi's request for a meeting on, quote, national reconciliation with the government and the army chief. And, of course, the military, very powerful in Myanmar, 25% of the seats in the parliament reserved for the military, as well as key ministries that remain in the hands of the military, no matter what happens with this election.
Has there been any statement since this from the government, from Aung San Suu Kyi?
We have not had a statement issued directly by her beyond the party officials at NLD headquarters releasing some details of this letter that came from the president in Naypyidaw. She has been fairly reserved in her comments since the election. She has told people not to cause trouble with celebrations, to wait for the results. She's instructed victorious politicians not to give interviews and not even to post on social media. Everyone seems to be waiting until these results are official from the Union Election Commission. There had been some concerns expressed by the NLD and some protests, especially about some of the advance votes, the absentee ballots. But regardless of what happens with those ballots, there's little doubt that overall for the parliamentary seats, it is going to be a landslide victory for the NLD.
And is there any indication yet as to when this vote counting process will conclude?
Well, it's coming out in dribs and drabs. A couple times a day, we're getting updates on the parliamentary seats. The UEC, the Election Commission, had said earlier that they would continue to release results through Sunday, which would be 1 week after the election. But I think within another day or two, we're going to see the official count take the NLD over the threshold of giving it an absolute majority in the parliament.
Among the parliamentary winners is Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi herself, who won re-election to her lower house seat in Kofmu constituency in Yangon State. This was the first election in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, since the military junta established a quasi-civilian government in 2011 after almost 50 years in power, and 1 year after Aung San Suu Kyi's two-decade-long house detention ended and a ban on her NLD party was lifted. There will be no members of the Muslim faith among the representatives in Myanmar's next parliament. The country's largest Muslim party, the United National Congress, conceded it will not win any of the seats it contested. Amnesty International says the Syrian government is carrying out a systematic campaign of enforced abductions to spread terror and quash dissent across the country. The human rights group says President Bashar al-Assad's government is profiting from a black market of middlemen who trade information on abductions in return for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Ola is 24 years old. She used to be a driving instructor in Syria, but she got involved with opposition activists. And 2 years ago, she was caught transporting defectors from the Syrian army to the Jordanian border. Speaking from her new home in Turkey, she describes her detention.
25 days بالمنفردة. ما في أكل.
She says she was held in solitary confinement for 25 days. There was no food, there were no blankets. They interrogated me normally at first, she says. Then they beat me with an electric cable. Ola, who asked that her real name not be used, says she was hung by her wrists for 6 days and repeatedly subjected to electric shock. She was released after more than a year in captivity after developing a blood clot. Amnesty International says at least 65,000 Syrians, the vast majority of them civilians, have experienced similarly terrifying ordeals. Many are still missing, says Amnesty's Claudia Schäufler.
We believe it's so widespread and so systematic that it does amount to a crime against humanity.
The government is targeting opponents of the regime, including political activists, doctors and journalists, and also their families. Survivors describe horrific stories of torture.
Being cuffed by the wrists and then hung up and then beaten in that position, or being held, like being suspended in that position for long periods of time, or being electrocuted, or otherwise also being exposed to sexual violence. And then when these people are being brought back into their cells, there is no medical attention, so many people die in custody.
Schäufler says the abductions have given rise to a black market industry of middlemen who are paid bribes by family members desperate to find out about their loved ones. Activists say the bribes are a source of income for the Syrian government. Syria's government has in the past denied accusations of abductions and torture. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
U.S. Republican presidential candidates back on the campaign trail after expressing support for strengthening American borders as they debated Tuesday night issues related to immigration, the economy, and the country's place in the world. But they had different opinions about what to do with the millions of illegal immigrants already living in the country. A new poll prior to the Milwaukee, Wisconsin debate showed neurosurgeon Ben Carson leading with 24%, and billionaire businessman Donald Trump just behind at 23%. Florida Senator Marco Rubio was a distant third with 12%. With Dr. Carson still high in the polls, Emily Cuday, political correspondent for Newsweek, spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson about who Ben Carson is.
Dr. Carson had a long career in medicine that hadn't really been explored too much so far in the presidential discussion, and as he's really surged in the polls. Obviously, I'm not the only one. There's a lot of us who are now suddenly a lot more interested in Dr. Carson, his story, his background, because with the lack of political experience that he's had, it makes his personal experience, his personal story, his experience as a doctor all that much more relevant in sort of trying to parse out who this guy is and what sort of qualities he would bring to the White House. So that's what I was interested in doing, was talking to people who worked with him at Johns Hopkins, who knew him from his time in Baltimore, to get a better sense of what he was like in those days, and also just how they reconcile this doctor, who was very well-known and well-respected in his field and in the community there, with a figure that they see on the campaign trail who's a little bit more controversial, both in terms of some of the things he said and also being sort of heavily partisan. It's a very different role for him.
What are some of these things that you have found in speaking with his former colleagues?
Well, it's interesting. I wasn't sure what to expect. I knew he was regarded very highly for his medical skills as a neurosurgeon, a pediatric neurosurgeon. But one of the things that people talked about a lot when I spoke with them was his people skills and how he's wonderful both with children, which is most of the patients he had were very young, and he was working on some pretty intractable problems these kids were facing. And it's important to have a good rapport with little kids who are, you know, you're working with as a doctor. But they also said he worked really well with other doctors, with other professionals and specialists. That's important, I think, in the medical field, just because they're all trying to work together, but there's a lot of pressure and a lot of ego. It sounded like he had a really good human touch, essentially.
Do you have a sense of how perhaps this narrative that he's developed over the years correlates with what he is saying now?
Yeah, it's certainly a storyline that's important to his identity, how he came up from nothing, basically, in Detroit and Boston, sort of living in poverty, but being very focused on his education and persevering, that he was able to work his way up through the Ivy League to this very prestigious medical center at Johns Hopkins and a very prestigious career. So I think that it informs a lot of his outlook on the role of government and his belief that it's really about taking your own initiative rather than taking government handouts. He never wanted, for example, any special treatment because of his ethnicity, because he was a minority. He just very much rejected those sort of race quotas or special treatment, those types of things. And I think it's because he felt like he was able to do it and other people should be able to do it.
Were there any other aspects of his life that you didn't know about that you uncovered during your discussions with others?
The one thing I learned that people really struggled with who know him well from his past life was they were having a hard time with some of the things he said about other religious groups, other types of people like homosexuals. I mean, some of the stuff that's come out that's been more divisive on social issues, I think, is where they were surprised that they didn't think that that was reflective of the way he'd always behaved as a doctor.
That's Emily Cuday, political correspondent for Newsweek. Her article is titled Carson's Journey, Pioneering Neurosurgeon, Presidential Candidate. She spoke with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Coming up, new buzz over urban bees. This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What would it be like to be able to go sightseeing in Rome 2,000 years ago? Well, now you can with a new app for iPad called Imperial Fora. This app lets you cruise through the ancient ruins of great public squares built by different Roman emperors, illustrating what these places looked like in real time. Let's let the app itself tell you more.
This application allows everyone to appreciate the transformations of Rome from antiquity until the present day, in a central point of the city, the area of the Imperial Fora. The project, created by 3D Rome, permits a real journey through time that can take place both on-site and elsewhere. The virtual visitor finds himself immersed in scenes that can be superimposed and highlight the main stages in the city's development.
This app comes with maps and a history tab and is, as the Imperial Fora website says, coming soon. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossons.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. White and Asian students in the United States continue to outperform their Black and Latin counterparts nationwide. That's the conclusion of a U.S. Department of Education 2015 report card assessing nationwide student achievement. Elizabeth Lee examines some of the causes of this persistent gap from Los Angeles, one of the most diverse cities in the country.
Negative infinity and death of right.
High school students Robin Choi and Jewel Prim share one key ingredient that makes them academically successful.
Ever since I can remember, college has never been a choice. It's something that's essential.
Well, my parents have always told me since I was a child that education was an investment to my career.
It's based on sales, no.
Both students attend Harvard Teacher Preparation Academy, a school that gives them as much support as they get at home. But not every school presents this type of experience. English teacher Natalie Collier says if students do not get basic academic skills by the time they reach high school, many of them become disinterested, and that is just one challenge.
The lack of motivation also comes from outside the environment. If most of the critical mass is not focused on education, then I believe it kind of trickles down and that becomes the influence.
Latino and Black students are most affected by socioeconomic challenges that keep them from excelling when compared to their white and Asian counterparts, says University of California, Los Angeles education professor Marcelo Suarez Orozco.
Both Latino children and African-American children are once again attending schools that are highly segregated. They're highly segregated by race, by poverty, by language, by legal status.
All factors that contribute to an achievement gap that continues into college, says Ken O'Donnell, California State University's Senior Director of Student Engagement.
If you're the first in your generation to come to college, then that's a strike against you. We have to work harder to keep those people in school because the support networks aren't in place.
O'Donnell says the achievement gap can have lasting repercussions.
The students who come to us underprepared are likelier to drop out and likelier to take longer to graduate. And so for their life outcomes after graduation, in terms of lifetime earnings, happiness, health outcomes, all those benefits that come with earning a degree, for them are delayed by at least several years and may not happen at all.
For many of today's teachers, UCLA's Suarez Orozco says reaching students means being sensitive to the cultural, linguistic, and economic barriers they face.
So knowing your students, knowing where they're coming from, knowing their communities.
But influences and responsibilities outside the classroom may continue to cause an achievement gap among Black and Hispanic students in many schools. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Turning now to our daily look at social media and the buzz online. Here's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
What do you have for us today?
I have a two-part segment on America's tipping culture. Ray, for international listeners, can you tell us a standard tipping rate here in America?
Well, it used to be about 15%, but now, more often than not, it's increased to about 20%.
Right. So let's say four people went out to eat and the bill came out to be $100, and they decided to split it evenly. So if you tip 20%, each person has to add $5 to the $20 they're paying for the meal. So no matter what the percentage, it can really add up. Of course, there are some mom-and-pop stores that don't accept tips, but that's really rare. I mean, I personally haven't been to a sit-down restaurant that doesn't accept tips. Have you?
No, I haven't, although sometimes I've been inclined not to tip, but I do anyway.
That's why Wednesday's announcement by a national seafood chain is getting a lot of attention on Facebook. Joe's Crab Shack is the first major chain restaurant to drop tipping for servers. So instead of getting tips, the servers will be paid a starting wage of $14 per hour, which is a bit higher than the national average.
Well, will that wage apply to all of its stores?
That's a plan in the long run, but it's starting out with stores in participating markets. They include Indianapolis, Omaha, St. Louis, and Pittsburgh. There's one catch, though. Joe's menu prices are increasing 12 to 15% as part of the move.
That seems not a lot, though, compared to the average tipping rate, isn't it?
Exactly. Ray, I'm glad you mentioned the average tipping rate because tipping is not mandatory. So some people apparently do not tip at all. And that's what the next story is about. A couple in Centerville, Ohio, is in the hot seat for not tipping and writing a not a very kind note to the waitress. It started out with the waitress posting a picture of the restaurant copy of the receipt that showed a big fat zero in the tip section and this comment. He is my husband. Find your own. Good luck. And she added a smiley face. The customer apparently felt that the waitress was flirting with her husband, so penalized her by not leaving any tip. The waitress then posted a picture of the receipt and wrote something scathing thing about the customer's behavior. That Facebook post has since been deleted, but it's already been covered by many media outlets. So as you can tell, the tipping culture can be conducive to drama sometimes. Ray?
Thanks for those tips on tipping and tipping us off. That's social media correspondent G. Abby Lee. She's on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. And that's not Bosco. And tweets from our program, it's account at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. More and more urban dwellers are starting to keep honeybees as a hobby, but a new study finds it might not be so good for the bees. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Honeybees are raised in tended colonies for their honey and raised to pollinate crops. But investigators have found that managed honeybees, particularly those in the city, get sicker and die more often than wild honeybees. Researchers at North Carolina State University in Raleigh studied 24 honeybee colonies managed by beekeepers in the city and outlying areas. They compared them to the health of honeybees in 15 wild colonies found in trees or buildings untended. Investigators studied the immune systems and so-called pathogen pressure on worker honeybees, or the disease-causing bugs they are exposed to. Steve Frank is an entomologist at NC State and co-author of a study published in the journal PLOS One. Frank says it appears honeybees kept by urban beekeepers face exposure to a greater number of bacteria and viruses than their wild cousins.
We're not sure of the mechanism, but one possible mechanism is that if in urban areas there's fewer flower patches to feed on, that more bees are visiting the same patches, and that could increase the rate of pathogen transmission from one bee to another.
Mortality among honeybees collected in urban environments was 3 times higher in the experiments compared to those collected in rural environments. However, investigators found the immune response of managed bees was not affected by urbanization. Differences in temperatures and more pollution could be taking a toll on managed bees in the city. But Frank says there's no reason at this point not to raise them.
I don't think beekeeping in the city should be discouraged at this point, but it does suggest that urban beekeepers might need to be more vigilant when it comes to monitoring their hives for pathogens or monitoring the health of their colonies.
Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
He's won the FIFA Player of the Year award 3 times. He's won the Golden Boot as European soccer's top scorer 4 times. And he has legions of adoring fans. Now, a new documentary looks at his life off the field. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the film Ronaldo, which looks at the life of Portuguese national and Real Madrid star Cristiano Ronaldo.
There's no arguing with Cristiano Ronaldo's skills on the football field. This year, the 30-year-old became Real Madrid's all-time leading scorer with 324 career goals. He scored 48 goals in 35 Spanish League games to win the Golden Boot for the 4th time. No other player has 4 of the scoring awards. He has won the Golden Ball as FIFA's Player of the Year 3 times and is nominated for a 4th trophy this year. But in a new documentary, Ronaldo, director Anthony Fonca takes fans behind the public sportsman to give us a glimpse of Ronaldo's life off the field. The documentary combines archival highlights with film shot over 14 months to give a look at the football star's life, particularly with his family. Cristiano Ronaldo says that he was able to relax in front of the camera, and it shows in the movie.
When I speak with the guys from Universal, they plan to do it like 3 days of filming, but I'm just feeling so comfortable and good chemistry with the director and Anthony and Paul that the thing is coming in a natural way. So in the movie that you're going to have opportunity to see that we have very intense moments, very private moments, because I was enjoying to do it, the filming. So I think the last result, I think it's great. You're going to have opportunity to see it was unbelievable.
Director Anthony Fonca says that he was surprised by the quiet life that one of the world's top football players lives off the field.
He lives actually a relatively, you know, strict life. You know, comes home and trains and sleeps and does that. It's no mad partying or, you know, it's... and so that was a surprise. His ability to deal with pressure is actually, that's fascinating. You know, he has this, he loves it, you know, and he thrives on it. And that was for me, was fascinating.
Winning, that's the most important to me. It's as simple as that.
Ronaldo's agent Jorge Mendes said at the London premiere that the film gives fans a chance to know Cristiano the man instead of Cristiano the football star.
I think that now you have a chance to know better Cristiano. And almost of the people, I think that you don't know really who is Cristiano. Everybody knows Cristiano as a player, but as a father and out of the pitch is really, I think that you should see the movie.
Nothing is impossible, my friend.
I have what I have because I sacrifice a lot.
Tudo que tenho desde que fui.
Some people hate me. Some people love me. Fui feito para ser o melhor.
Ronaldo is produced by the same team that released documentaries on Formula One racing champion, the late Ayrton Senna of Brazil, and the late British pop singer Amy Winehouse. It is rated PG-13 and is in theaters now. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Benjamin Rhodes announced on October 16th $2.2 million in new U.S. support for Laos National Mine Clearance Operator, UXOs Lao, which will enable it to rehire trained technicians it lost in 2014 as a result of funding difficulties. The UXO Lao teams will be deployed in Wampan, Sing Quang, Quan Mon, Savanakhet, Salavan, and Champasak provinces. Mr. Rhodes said that the United States is committed to helping Laos clear unexploded ordnance, or UXO, contaminated areas in order to reduce casualties and to increase the productivity of agricultural lands to reduce poverty. Mr. Rhodes recently visited a UXO Lao team clearing unexploded ordnance from Bonpaku village in Luang Prabang province. The UXO Lao team briefed Mr. Rhodes on its progress in the village and described the training that the team members must undertake in order to work in this sector. Mr. Rhodes said that he was impressed by the UXO Lao team's commitment to this work, which is so important for the Lao people and especially for the younger generation. With the new contribution, the United States will have provided more than $100 million in mine action and UXO-related assistance to Laos. Priority funding will support clearance of UXO found as a result of evidence-based survey, a cutting-edge technique that identifies contaminated areas more effectively and efficiently than ever before. Victims assistance programs will provide direct services to survivors of unexploded ordnance accidents and their families and help strengthen first aid and emergency response of key health facilities and village volunteers in heavily impacted provinces. Funding for risk awareness supports education of Lao citizens, especially children, about the dangers of UXO. USAID's Leahy War Victims Fund provided funding to the Cooperative Orthotic Prosthetic Enterprise to support physical rehabilitation programs, including prosthetics, orthotics, and mobility aids to nearly 4,500 people, including 1,500 children. The United States is proud to work with Laos and its non-governmental partners to free the people of Laos from the threat of landmines, unexploded ordnance, and other deadly remnants of war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.